Hi, welcome to another episode of Innovation Deciphered. I'm Ben Pritchard, I'm your host this week. And this week I've got the opportunity to talk to Ben Cantwell, Innovation Director at Cromec. And we're hearing all about their amazing journey from a spin-off at Durham University and how they've used their own technology, how they've created a number of products that are helping create a safer world for all of us. It is fantastic to hear how they've really embedded innovation in everything they do. Plenty to learn about, plenty to get excited about. It's a fantastic episode, even if I do say so myself. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe. Any comments or questions, please do drop them in the bottom, and I'm sure we will be in touch soon. Ben, welcome to Innovation Deciphered. It's great to have you here. Really excited to hear about your journey and the journey that Cromec have been on over the last 21 years
it is now. 21 years. This month. Yeah.
And sort of from relatively humble beginnings, I guess, at Durham University, you're now a global sort of listed company with innovation at your heart.
Yeah, so we started in back 21 years ago now, as a spin-off from Durham University. So at Durham, they'd been working since the 1970s on some technology to grow a type of crystal in a novel way. The crystal that were grown was called cadmium telluride, and a similar one called cadmium zinc telluride, which you could use. It's very good, got very good properties as a radiation detector. So they've been developing different techniques to grow the crystal at Durham for about 30 years. And the technique that they used was very different to everyone else. I did my degree at Durham, then came in the degree last year, final year, did a project with one of the lecturers there, and found what I was doing quite interesting. It was kind of in a related field, and thought, oh, I quite fancy carrying on to do this, to do a PhD as well. So I asked them if there's a chance of doing a PhD, and just so happened there was. So I started a PhD, kind of carrying on the development of that crystal growth technology. That started in 2000. Then towards the end of my PhD, there was a company came to see the university to ask if they could buy the crystals that we were growing commercially. Turned out it didn't happen in the end, but someone at the technology transfer office at the university, he got involved in the in what we were doing at that stage. And he'd had a previous life as an entrepreneur at Nottingham Trent University. And around that time as well, he created a spin-off company from there. And he sold his shares. Someone came in with an offer around that time. He sold the shares. We had a pot of money in order to be able to invest. He'd seen what we were doing. He knew from his previous work, which was on 3D X-ray imaging, he knew the potential of this material. So people had known the potential of the materials since the 1950s, but the difficulty had always been getting a reliable way to grow the material commercially and selling it. So he kind of said, I'd like to invest and form a company. So there was myself and someone else within the research group formed the company just as I was finishing my PhD. So in 2003, we formed what we called Durham Scientific Crystals. Durham, because we were based in, spin out from Durham University. Crystals, because we grow crystals. And scientific, because when we started telling people, they thought they were healing crystals and things like that. So we put the word scientific there to kind of, to show what we were doing. So the idea was that we'd grow these crystals and we'd sell them commercially. Kind of the strap line we had was the crystals were 10 times the value of gold by weight. So that was kind of what our strap line was early on. But as we were kind of developing it and we started to kind of look for investors and talk to external people, we had to realize we need a story to tell. So just saying, we've got this crystal, it can detect radiation well, it's got a good spectral resolution, that's not really going to get people excited. So what we were able to do is kind of, it was around the time when people were transferring from film cameras to digital cameras. So we were able to kind of give the picture that what we were doing is effectively from X-rays going from kind of film to digital. And also because the crystals that we grow, you can use them as well as just measuring the kind of the X-rays coming in. You can also measure the energy of the X-rays. and effectively different energies or different colours. So we were able to paint a picture that actually would be taken x-ray from black and white to colour. And once we started to be able to kind of give that picture, that's when that was easier to sell the story and then get people on board. So yeah, so this started 2003 as a two-man company. Decided quite early on that initially we were based at the university, but realised quite early on we didn't just want to be a university spin-out company who just stayed small and carried on. We wanted to be a proper company, so when we went in, we made sure we didn't dress as students. We dressed smartly and suits and things like that.
Stood out a mile in.
Tried to sit out a mat. We like to think we were important. We were, but we tried to make it look as though we were. So that we did a lot of things like that, but we realised we had to move out to the university. So around that time, they were getting built in just outside Durham. There's a site called Net Park was first getting built, and that was an old mental hospital that had closed down. Because through care in the community. So the local council bought the land and then decided they'd build a technology park on it. So they started building the technology park in there in, I think, 2003. And we were the first tenants moving in there at the end of 2004. So we moved in there as a two-man company.
In some ways, I guess it would have been quite easy as well to just grow and sell the crystals. I mean, it sounds like that would have been quite a good lucrative business. But as you're throughout your journey, you've continued to innovate, continue to create new products, and you must have, I mean, how many patents do you guys have now?
I think we've got about 130 different patent families, of which probably about 80 or 90 of those have granted patents within them. And so that gives us, around looking at different territories, over 200 patents altogether granted, and then we've got quite a number of applications still going. So we've got a big patent portfolio.
And what was it that you felt the need, was it need, desire, or a bit of both to have that continual innovation, to continue to push the boat out as a company?
I think we soon realised that growing crystals, we'd hit the ceiling. So what we need to do is move up the value chain. So first of all, just growing crystals, but then actually making detectors out of the crystals, we'd move up the value chain, and then ultimately growing end user products. So we realized quite early on that actually we want to be higher up the value chain. So we started innovating in the various areas in order to be able to do that. Part of the reason as well, because this was it's a novel technology and people didn't really know how to use it. Mm-hmm. So we felt that if we kind of developed the capabilities in-house, then we'd be able to help educate the potential customers so that we can help show them the potential of the technology, the potential of these detectors, and then kind of bring the innovations to the fore there.
And as with all new technologies, but especially in sort of the areas and sectors you're looking at, you know, healthcare, nuclear, and all these areas, they're highly regulated. So new technology is sort of you get quite high barriers to entry there. That must have been quite a difficult part of your journey.
It was, yeah. And one of the first kind of end user products we decided we created was in 2006, there was the liquid ban brought in on when someone tried to take a liquid explosive on an aircraft, and they brought in a liquid ban overnight. Then I think within a year or two, they brought out regulations for what they'd need to do in order to be able to lift the ban, and what scanners they'd need. And so I think they committed to kind of, the European Parliament committed to lifting the ban in 2010. So we saw an opportunity there. There was already, in aviation security, there's a lot of incumbents already working, but there was no systems at that time that could detect liquid explosives. So we realized our technology, if you shone an X-ray through a bottle and used our detector, because we can detect effectively in color, we can see if there's liquid explosives in there. So we developed this, and we created the first, our system was the one which was first certified by ECAC, by the European Test House. So we were the first company to get certified in the first round to the highest standard, and that was back in 2010. So within about 2 years, we'd created a technology from scratch and then got it certified, with the expectation that in 2010, the liquid ban would get lifted. Mm-hmm. Airports would all need to buy these scanners, and then
not quite. But not it's quite. Starting to happen now, though.
It's starting to happen. It's starting to happen now. But we'd imagine that 2010, because it was a regulated industry, and the European Parliament had said we're going to lift the ban and that would happen. But it turns out that obviously that didn't happen. The lifting of the ban was postponed a number of times. Mm. And effectively, it's only really happening now.
Yeah.
With kind of the next generation of X-ray scanners.
So that must be quite difficult as well. It's not just highly regulated industries you're going into, but it's sort of quite risk-averse industries.
Yeah.
You know, I'm predominantly in the construction industry, which is historically seen as very risk-averse and in turn not very innovative. So you're pushing it almost too closed doors to try and get a lot of your technology into.
Yeah, and it's quite an interesting industry, the aviation industry, because it's the airports who would buy the systems, but it's the regulators who kind of impose what the regulations are. So to try and persuade, unless it's regulated, try and persuade airports that they need to buy these machines, that they need to pay for, and that they need to staff, that's quite a difficult sell.
And slightly different regulations depending on where in the world you are as well.
Yeah.
So the complication of going to market and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So we sold a number of products there, but I don't think we didn't get the traction that I think we imagined because the regulations didn't change as quickly as we'd imagine. But I think we saw a lot of products. We developed a lot of technology then. We developed a lot of know-how and we matured very much as a company. And I think we learned as well that just developing technology alone isn't enough. You need to look at what the end users are and look at all who are the end users, who makes the decisions on purchasing, who's making the decisions to use them, who's actually going to use them. There's different users and they've all got different motivations, and what you need to do is trying to get your technology was kind of try and hit all of those different stakeholders.
Yeah, so we talk a lot about sort of an innovation journey, so from sort of a good idea to an exploitable asset, and some of that is, you know, in your early stage, you know, what's the problem statement, and is it a me problem statement or an us problem statement? You're trying to understand, you know, you hear a lot of terms like addressable market and things like that. And it's important because you can have great ideas that go nowhere.
Yeah.
We've seen plenty of them. It's quite hard, and I guess it's there must be some nearly as many painful times in your journey as there are some great times as well.
I think so, yeah. And I think part of the need is it's often quite difficult to get that need. There's a famous quote from Henry Ford who said, "I've asked people what they wanted, I'd have built a faster horse." And that's kind of what we were getting, because we've got a completely groundbreaking technology. But when you ask people what they need, oh, I want this to be a little bit better. I want this to be a little bit better. And it's actually finding out what the problems are that we can solve rather than just asking people, what do you want? And so actually talked.
I love the sort of the Henry Ford story as well, because everyone thinks that the only thing he was trying to do was replace the horse or create sort of a cheaper automotive. But what the problem he was trying to solve there to an extent was inequality in America. And what he was trying to do was if you could get middle America to the coast quicker so that they could sell goods and stuff like that, then you would bring income and equality back to middle America. So it's very, you know, it was a social problem that he was trying to solve with the technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting when you start looking at these different sort of technological sort of breakthroughs through history, and actually often it's a social sort of issue that it's trying to overcome in some way, shape or form. It's sort of really interesting to dig down to what problem you're really trying to solve.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of time to, those often aren't easy questions to answer and ask. So it's a lot of separating the signal from the noise and actually just going out and talking to people and then asking the right questions and spending the time to listen is kind of what's needed an awful lot of the time.
It is. So we've gone from sort of the two man on the outskirts of Durham. You're now sort of, you know, global.
Yeah.
You're now sort of, you've got a large sort of operation in America as well as here in the UK. So your healthcare is one of your biggest areas. Nuclear, so where else are you focused on at the moment?
So we've got two major areas. One is in medical. So these scanners are like the detectors we make are likely to be used in kind of two major emerging products within the medical sector. One is SPECT, which is a nuclear imaging technique whereby somebody is injected with a radio tracer and it preferentially congregates in a tumour and then spreads out gamma rays. And then what you use is use our detectors to detect the gamma rays. And because of the crystals we use, we can do that much greater efficiency, and we can also look at kind of get better images there. So that's those are some technologies which are just starting to get adopted now, kind of the next generation of those. And then there's another technology which is called CT. A lot of people have been for a CT scan. So kind of the next generation of those is going to be, again, like going from grayscale black and white to color. So by using our detectors, you'll be able to use a lot, you'll get a lot smaller artifacts, so you'll be able to get much better diagnostic performance within there.
So it feels like it wouldn't be a sort of a conversation about technology without sort of bringing in AI and stuff like that. So yeah. Are you sort of looking at how you can create models to look at sort of results and try and sort of model what these things could mean in a better, more efficient way as well?
So I think we've got, in terms of AI, there's almost, there's the positive and there's the negative for us. In terms of the positive, what we're able to do is use AI to kind of improve the performance of our detectors. And in terms of things like the electrical signal, how you use that, how you can improve the performance. But there's the difficulty we've got is that some of the existing technologies have got built up databases of millions of scans. Mm. But when you're developing a new technology, you don't have that amount of data built up. So it's not as easy to replace incumbent technologies which have got kind of the library that you can build up AI on. So
you've got nothing to train it with. So
yeah, you've got nothing to train it with. A lot of work goes into creating artificial training data, but then it's not quite the same as actually having those millions of diagnostic scans from the real world. But yeah, so AI,
it's there.
It's there. It's how we can best use it.
Yeah. So obviously one of the, universities have been a big part of your journey, sort of starting at Durham, but obviously now, so we were talking before we started, so you have sort of research ongoing with sort of Manchester, Bristol, a number of universities around the UK. And it's something that I've sort of noticed with the construction industry especially, but I think if you compare the UK economy with the US and a few others around the world, I don't think we're good enough at how industry and universities work together to sort of exploit good research and turn them into ultimately what we want is an exportable sort of service product or something else. What do you think in terms of your journeys would be some of the key learnings for you from getting those relationships working, how we can share that and do more of it?
I think it's partly understanding each other's motivations. It's partly the motivation for industry is ultimately you need to be creating products to make money. And then but the motivations of universities is often kind of what's in their constitutions is they need to be public empowerment, they need to be creating papers, creating information that isn't necessarily aligned to kind of how you might develop a product if you're don't want to give all the secrets away. It's partly that. So I think it's understanding each other's motivations. I think it's regular alignment on what you do. And what kind of how we see universities useful is we do R&D, but when we do it, it's difficult to stay at the cutting edge of a lot of things, whereas the universities often are at the cutting edge. Mm-hmm. So trying to kind of keep on dialing into the universities allows us to see what the real low TRL technology coming out of them is that can be exploited later on. But I think it needs expectations on both sides from the universities that it's going to take a period of time in order to commercialise any technology that they're developing. So we're 20 years old now, 21 years old now, and we're still working on the commercialization of the technology. It's not something that happens in 18 months.
No.
These are long journeys. But I think a lot of it is regular communication. So it's going talking to the universities, having good relationships with people and finding people you can work with, I think a lot of the time. If you find academics who kind of suit your working style and you suit theirs, then I think that's often a lot of the
How do you grow those relationships and find them? Is it you approaching universities with a problem statement and trying to find someone that'll help you overcome it? Or do they come to you and say, we think we've got some cool stuff over here that sort of fits with what you do?
I think there's a mix of everything. So we often sit on various panels. So I've sat on an STFC cancer diagnostic panel, I've sat on the Quantic Market Opportunities panel where there's industry, there's universities. So you get to see some of the technology coming out of it. And then what you've got to try and do is trying to look at what problems have we got, trying to see what technology is coming out and seeing if you can marry them together. So there's no one way, I don't think, to say this is exactly what you should do. I think a lot of it is just kind of talking to people, building up those relationships, building up those networks. And then some of it is serendipity. Some of it is just talking to the right person at the right time. Just as something's passed your desk, a problem passed your desk, that suddenly that crops up.
Will those type of things be sort of Innovate UK, the Horizon Funds and those type of stuff? Are those the type of opportunities that often help sort of make that relationship click and go?
Yeah, so we've done a number of Innovate UK projects with different universities. So King's College down the road, we had a project about 10 years ago with them. We're doing something with UCL at the minute on a different thing with various other, with various other partners as well. Horizon Europe, not so much the UK, because of just because of the way that the kind of the funding needs work, that we're looking at
political decisions have made that difficult.
Actually, we've been looking, we just got a Horizon UK project started this last I think it was last month through the Horizon Europe Guarantee, so I must I'd be wrong if I didn't say that we didn't get some help there, but I think just the way Horizon set up, it more encourages you to work with universities on the continent than it does in the UK, because you need partners in different countries. We've also we've had funding from the American government. Over the years, we've had quite a bit of funding from the American government, and we've there, Manchester and Liverpool were universities who we did a project with there. So we try and marry up as well. Part of our journey is, instead of just getting funding from investors, we try and get funding from Innovate UK and from other partners. So we've been very successful in getting US government funding for different developments, particularly in kind of in the radiation detection sectors, and where that allows us to do kind of some early stage research, partnering with different universities there.
So when you talk about sort of what next, and a bit of sort of horizon scanning, I mean, what sort of forward plan do you guys have at Cromec? Are you looking at what technology that you're hoping to develop in the next 18 months, 18 years? I mean, how much future gazing do you guys do?
So I think we do an awful lot. So we've got technology that we're trying to bring to the market now. So we've got kind of a steady stream now within the what we call the CBRN detection sector. So looking for radiological threats. One of the detectors we make, which was initially funded by the US government by DARPA, is a small handheld radiation detector. That the idea is they had a problem whereby they realised that the borders in the US are quite porous. I think, as famously Trump has said previously, what they tried to do was detect radiation, detect people bringing radioactive and nuclear material at the borders. Realised that's not the way to do it. So the visionary of DARPA realised we've got a lot of people who travel about the city every day. So policemen, firemen, postal workers. If we give all of them a radiation detector, or a number of them a radiation detector, what you'll be able to do is build a picture of radiation levels across the city, and then see if there's anything looks suspicious. So we won the contract to develop a radiation detector with them, and it's been really successful. And now we're kind of working on different variants of that to sell to different sectors within the US and within the UK and within Europe. So that's a business that's growing for us. That's kind of, over the next few years, will continue to grow, particularly as geopolitical things, what's happening in Ukraine, is that's unfortunately, but for us, it's an opportunity there. So that's growing steadily. In the medical market, I think that's going to, that once this spec starts to take off in the next 3, 4, 5 years, the spectral CT will really shoot up, and that will kind of be where kind of the big market will be. So we're looking, so in that market, that's a bit longer term than kind of in the spec market. And we're also, we diversified a few years ago as well. So the DARPA idea was, let's look for radiological and nuclear threats in a city. What if, can we use the same sort of idea to look for chemical and biological threats? So we, because we've been successful on the DARPA work for the radiological detectors, they said, can you see if you can go out and find how you can detect biological threats? So we went out and we found some technology which could do that. So ended up working with a couple of you, with the Natural History Museum and the Ulm Institute, and we're funded to do research there by DARPA, and we've developed some technology there to detect airborne biological threats using sequencing. And then I think that was starting around 2019. 2020, there was a pandemic caused by an airborne biological threat. So now we're still developing this technology, but we're trying to see initially, instead of just as a kind of as a security aspect, how do you use that to detect the next pandemic? Mm. So that's something as well that's going to come before in the next few years.
So Chromec, the company no one might have heard of that's making the world safer every day. It's fantastic. It's been really interesting talking to you today, mm-hmm. Ben, sort of hearing a little bit more about that journey you've been on, some of the exciting things that you've already created and are creating that will, by the sounds of it, really sort of, you know, help us globally become a much safer place from a range of threats that we probably don't even know about.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for sharing your journey, and I hope everyone